Okay. Before we start, I'm going to throw in one more of the non-technical suggestions to you guys, which I think is actually something that somebody was in my office the other day for advising, and I was telling them this, and I thought actually this is something that you guys should know it too. So as I know that most of you are freshmen, right? I know some of you actually are juniors and maybe even sophomores and juniors at least, but for those who just started, so you'll notice that there are prerequisites especially for computer science. You know, you would be doing, you know, one level courses, then two level courses, then three level, then four level. So there is, if you look at a prerequisite tree, it might look like this. I won't, you know, there is some number of one level courses. And then there are some level two level courses. These numbers are not the real numbers. And then there are some three level courses. And then there are a whole bunch of four level courses. Okay. Now, most of you probably would think that it's a reasonable idea. And then there obviously are prerequisites for these, right? In the sense, 100 is normally required to take any of the 200 courses. Not all, you know, some 100 level courses are required to take 200 courses. Some 200 courses are required to take some 300 courses. And then some of the 300 courses are required to take some of the 400 courses. So there's a prerequisite graph. So the question is, how do you traverse this graph? You know, because that's how you take the courses. Okay. One idea, and people tend to do it a lot, I don't know whether you already thought about this or not, is get all the one level courses done, then do all the two levels, then do all the three levels, and then do the four levels. There are some possible advantages for it, but I would suggest that you consider also think seriously about the, so that by the way, in fact, there's a computer science concept here. You know, if you are going through this graph by level, by level, by level, that's called breadth first search over a graph. Okay? So you're essentially taking all the zero depth nodes first, you know, and expanding it, or actually taking those courses. Okay? Then after that, you take all the next level courses, then you take all the next level courses. So if you think of this as a graph with vertices and these prerequisites as the edges, then it would correspond to a breadth first traversal. If you were going to do one level first, then two, then three, then four. One problem with that, I mean, there are some advantages to this, right? Which is, if you're taking one level courses with all the other people taking one level courses, you'll probably know all the other students taking. I mean, it's hard enough that in the universities that you barely see each other in any other class, you know, unlike in high school. Okay, so there is something to be said for doing it in lockstep. Okay, but university is completely different anyway. You know, it's all essentially you try to do things that are most interesting to you, so you have a lot of flexibility. So given that, I would suggest a different traversal. I'm not saying that you should all do it, but think about the alternative too. And that alternative is depth first traversal, unlike breadth first, depth first traversal of the prerequisite tree. Okay, what does that mean? You take some 100 level courses, and as soon as, you know, instead of completing all the 100 level courses, you start seeing which 200 level courses can you now take, given that you have done a couple of 100 level courses. And you do them. And then by the third semester, you would be able to do the three level courses. And then as soon as, in fact, there are certain critical courses like 310, which is data structures. If you have data structures under your belt, then entire variety of four level courses can be taken, because you know, 310 is pretty much the main prerequisite for many of those courses. It's not that there are no other prerequisites, none of the other guys are prerequisites for any other courses. It's just that there are, I think, as I remember it, 310 is one of these courses that you need to do several of the software oriented courses at least, for example. Okay, and if you do that, then in essence, while you are doing, after 310, you can start taking four level courses. And so you would have, in the same semester, you might be taking, you know, after third semester, fourth semester or something, you will likely be able to take a four level course while you are doing a two level course and a one level course. Okay, this might look crazy, but it actually has several advantages. One of which is most of the fun stuff about, you know, computer science that would actually be, that you might be interested in learning about, actually happens in four level. Okay, and this stuff, I mean, there are lots of interesting things that happen here too, but you know, this is closer to the bleeding edge. And furthermore, there are several courses, so there are two types of courses that computer science department offers in four level. Anything, you know, there are 4XX and there is 494, where XX happens to be 9 and 4, okay? And the 494 courses, they are essentially new courses that are made up in the last couple of years, maybe just that year, you know, that some faculty member thinks would be relevant for undergraduate students, you know, and because they're very interesting. Currently, some industry would be very interested in, you know, people having that background and so on. And you, there are a variety of these 494 courses. So if you actually look at the current offerings in computer science, you'll see a whole bunch of them which are 494. Okay? And those are the there are non-catalog courses in the sense 494 might actually later on become a standard course, but it's also just offered, you know, starting like this year, for example, or starting last 2 years or something. And there's just a whole bunch of these courses that you can actually do, and it would be useful to do them earlier rather than keep them all into the last year. In particular, if you, when you get to the senior year, okay, most of you will have already decided what you want to do right after the senior year. And you would be very busy making plans for that stuff. You know, if you're looking for jobs, then pretty much the very last semester is totally gone. And even before the last semester is probably gone because you're very busy applying and so on. And you know, if you go to an interview, people would like you, like to know, of course, whether you know all this stuff, but you can also, they also want to know whether you know some of the main areas such as operating systems or AI or databases or security. You know, several of you guys said computer security, right? That's where you got into, you know, computer science. And there are several nice security courses, but they're all offered at four levels. Okay? And if you basically said, I'll do all these courses and then do this, then in the senior year, apart from being particularly tense about jobs, etc., you're also trying to learn all these fun things. And it would be nice to transfer some of them to earlier on. And if there's a kind of a 3-level course left, you don't mind doing it, you know, in the senior year. It's, nobody is really, I mean, there are people here who are actually juniors, okay, but you don't know, right? And they don't mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? We are not standing up and saying, oh, this person is a junior, this person is a freshman, and so on. And so you can decide your traversal through this graph. And since I'm told by several people that the advising office suggests as a default a breakfast traversal, you will anyway hear about it. So you are now hearing about some possible advantages for depth first traversal, okay? You obviously, your mileage may vary and you may want to do what you like to do, but I'm just at least bringing that up, okay? Because I have seen lots of people who basically come to the senior year, they're just too busy and they wish they had time, but you know, they just don't have the time to take any really hard courses, okay? No, that's fine, 10 minutes we still have. Sorry. Any questions on this? I just thought I should get this off my chest. And, you know, maybe it's useful for you. If you, nobody else ever told you this, this might be useful. Yes, sir.
What do you think about, like, taking courses over the summer, too? Like, taking a really hard course over the summer?
First of all, most of the summer courses, I mean, very rarely do you get four-level courses offered in the summer. Okay, and so you do get 3 and 2 level courses offered in the summer. Okay. And remember what I said in the very beginning of the semester. I asked you, do you know my homepage? And do you know what my interests are? And my point was, why would you take a course with somebody whom you haven't researched? Because you're going to waste your time for a semester, okay? And it doesn't matter when you take the course, you want to know who is teaching it. You know, there are several many very good teachers in ASU, but there are also several people who probably won't care. And that's just true everywhere. Okay, it's not surprising. And you also want to see whether their style of teaching is likely to be the one that you would like. Okay, if those happen, then, you know, taking two-level, three-level courses in summer, there's no problem at all. Four-level is unlikely to be offered. Sometimes they offer some four-level courses, but not often. Okay, because part of the other part that you need to understand how the university system works, you know, in a public school, a research public school like ASU, is most tenure track faculty members are essentially judged both on their teaching and on their research. Okay, and there is lecturers who are judged mostly, their performance is judged mostly on their teaching. Okay, now in computer science is one of these areas where to even teach four level courses well, you should be doing research in that area, because things are changing. I mean, stuff that I taught 5 years back, I don't teach anymore. This is not true in physics, right? Physics, you have four level courses that haven't changed that often, although physics itself is changing, but to get there, you have to do eight level course. Computer science has the advantage that by doing, you know, you can do some, you know, like there are no security courses very until like 2 years back in anywhere, but now we have several of them. And they happen right at the same time when people are very interested in having, you know, hiring people with background in computer forensics and security and cryptography, etc. Okay, so in some sense, the area turns on a dime because it's like a relatively new area. Computer science as a discipline didn't exist when I did my undergraduate study. There was no computer science. Okay, and I think when I was in like fourth year or something, that's when computer science started happening in my school. And I think in US it probably happened maybe about a few years before that, okay? But it's a relatively new discipline, but it's also very fast evolving. And so getting the right four level courses under your belt is quite important, okay? And those are taught normally by research active faculty. And normally research active faculty may not teach in summer. Okay, I'm bringing this whole thing up, you know, just to give you how the system works. And you, once you figure out how the system works, you can use it any which way you want. Okay, and because they wind up doing research in summer. Okay, and so normally, if you do have courses, mostly the service courses, one level, two level courses are always offered in the summer, but four level much less likely. Any other questions? Okay. So, let's see. We were talking about this stuff last time, and apparently I looked at some of the answers. The first set of answers, several of them were very correct, but there seemed to have been like a slew of them after yesterday night and before this morning, I guess, because now I think from six, now it's become 14 responses, which is good. I will read them later. But since we are here, let's talk about these. The first one says, search engine that apparently my friend wrote tries to return all the documents in its database, no matter what the query. So if you give all the answers, so you whatever the query, you just return all the records in the database. Okay, is that going to be having high precision or high recall? And I would like to hear from people who are not sure. Okay, because remember, this is a fail-soft class. You know, your grade doesn't depend on anything here. I mean, as long as you are paying some attention and sort of indulge me once in a while, you're fine. Okay, so it's not that I'm holding like big final test, but it's this stuff. You know, you may as well understand this. So, so is it the precision or the recall that's going to, you know, are they both going to be very high, or one of them is going to be low, one of them is going to be high? Does everybody know what the answer is? Okay, So some people at least said they didn't. So let me just go through it. For those of you who know, you know, that's fine, it's a repetition. Precision essentially is as a ratio of the number of relevant answers you returned by the total number of answers you returned. Okay? And the recall is the number of relevant answers you returned divided by the total number of relevant answers that are there. Okay? Now, in this guy's case, he's sending all records as answers to anybody's query. That means for precision, the denominator is going to be, if the database had 1,000 records, the denominator is always going to be 1,000. Now, if the question that I asked only has one answer, then the numerator cannot be more than one. Okay? So the precision is going to be 1/1,000. Do you understand that? Okay? Whereas recall, on the other hand, would be 100%. Because if in fact there's only one answer for this query, since I returned all 1,000 tuples, one of them is going to be the answer that you're looking for. So I gave you 100% recall. Okay? And the point of this is, if you want to just optimize either recall or precision, that's easy. As I told you, you know, you may want to remember this example, that if you don't speak at all, you will have very low recall but very high precision. Because if you don't speak, then you can't make mistakes. Okay? And if you keep talking, then hopefully just by, you know, like monkeys typing and a typewriter producing Shakespeare before time ends, you know, if you keep talking, you're probably going to say some right answer, I mean, all the right answers by the end of the time. So that would be 100% recall, but very low precision, because any 24-hour period of time, probably you didn't make any sense. You didn't get any answer right. Okay? You can get very high precision or very high recall. The trick is to get both at the same time. That's when you need smart ideas. Okay, that was the point of that question. So this one, you are trying to find all the movies directed by Woody Allen, and so gave the query Woody Allen directed to the search engine. Suppose that it returns all the IMDb records where IMDb, you know, does anybody actually not know what IMDb is? And yeah, okay, IMDb is Internet Movie Database. Okay, and it's one of the few actually reputed databases on the internet which didn't make much money. You know, anything else which started supposedly trying to help people went, you know, became, you know, private, started putting advertisements, made a lot more money. IMDb doesn't make anywhere near that much money, but it's pretty reputed. You know, in general, it has a very comprehensive list of all the movies that were made. And in fact, so how many of you know the Kevin Bacon game? Kevin Bacon game essentially is given any arbitrary Hollywood star. It actually turns out it doesn't even have to be Hollywood star, you know. You can even give an arbitrary Bollywood star, which is an Indian actor. You can still find a series of movies such that Kevin Bacon acted with somebody in the first movie. That somebody acted with somebody else in the second movie. That somebody else acted with somebody else in the third movie. And then that last guy acted with the guy you were talking about in India in the fourth movie. And that would be the distance, Kevin Bacon distance. Now, if you want to compute Kevin Bacon distance for example, some random actor, you can use IMDb, because it has all the information about which, you know, people acted in which movies, for example. And anyway, so the important thing here is IMDb is going to be having clean data, mostly. They're very unlikely to be, you know, incorrect. Okay? So given that, I just want all the Woody Allen movies. That's the point. And this was an interesting question where most people thought what matters is precision and not recall. Okay, precision means only return the movies that are actually made by Woody Allen. Even if you just return one movie and just say Annie Hall. By the way, do you even know Woody Allen, the director? Any of you have seen movies? Okay. He still makes movies. I think in fact there's one that's coming out just now. Woody Allen is a reasonably prolific movie maker, so if you want to get all his movies, it turns out if you just give one movie of his, you're likely to be missing a whole bunch of his movies. Okay, so if I just return Annie Hall, which is the movie for which he got Oscar and so on. Okay, that will have 100% precision because you only returned one movie and that is really made by Woody Allen. But the recall is going to be 1/50 or something because I think he made about 50 movies. Okay, so now I wanted you to actually realize that since when the movie is returned to you, you can read the record to see whether it is really directed by Woody Allen or not. So what matters to you actually is recall, not precision. Okay, suppose they gave, you know, 57 movies in, you know, with seven of Coppola's, Francis Ford Coppola's movies thrown in, you would just remove those seven and you still got all the 50 Woody Allen movies. Okay, so the point again is sometimes recall is important, sometimes precision is important. On search engines, when you do Google, for example, what is more important for you, precision or recall? Precision. Okay, do you so here is an interesting story which only in computer science can you say 1997-1998 was historical. Okay, in the sense, back in the old days, in 1997 time frame, there used to be a search engine before, you know, the current crop of search engines called InfoSeek. And what they used to do is if you give it a query, they will show the first 10 results and they'll say, if you pay us some money, we will give you the next 50,000 results. Do you understand what I'm saying? So do you actually hear about InfoSeek as a search engine now? Why do you think they went out of business? Because they didn't realize what we all know now, which is in search engines, what matters is the precision, not the recall. And nobody really ever looks at the second page. Mostly they don't even look at beyond the first few results. Okay, there are very interesting experiments where people were trying to decide whether or not actually Google has high precision. Okay, and so they would try to ask people, did you actually find that the result that the Google said is the first result for your query? Is that really the most important result? And many people were saying, yes, yes, yes. And so that looked like Google was a very high precision engine. But then somebody got this question. Did these people know what they're really looking for? Or did they believe that what they're looking for is what Google said what they're looking for? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, you have some, you know, you have a search engine, a query, and sometimes you just take the top result because you believe that search engine knows more than you. And so you just actually say, oh, that is what I must have been looking for. And so if you're a computer scientist and you're trying to check whether or not a search engine is good or not, you have to set up experiments, right? And these are human experiments where humans are being asked, is this search engine actually giving you more relevant results in the top 10 results than this other search engine. Okay, so they set up this experiment and found in the first set, you know, people were saying, yeah, Google is coming, you know, way ahead of other guys. And then somebody got this idea that maybe they are actually biased. So what they did was the following. They set up experiment where they would put a little program which intercepts the top 10 results that Google sent, scrambles them, scrambles the order. Okay, in particular, they scrambled the order such that the one it said was number two was put in number one, and the one it said is number one was put in number two, and then shown to the user. What do you think user said was the most relevant result? Still the number one result, because they assumed Google knows. Okay, so in fact, they actually were able to show, you know, these experiments were able to conclusively demonstrate that a sufficiently effective technology makes you think that what that technology provides you is what you always looked for. Okay, so in this case, actually, it's not obvious that Google actually was giving the high precision. Once we start trusting a search engine, we think whatever it said is really what we're looking for. So precision and recall are not all that easy to, you know, judge, actually. So people do these kinds of interesting experiments. Okay, the other thing was I'm considering viewing documents as bags and use bag similarity measure to compute their similarity. I am considering three bag representations, documents as bags of letters, documents as bags of words, documents as bags of sentences. What are the trade-offs? And do people remember what we meant by bag representation for a document? we looked at it last time. Let me show you that once again. Okay, that's actually the bag representation. As somebody pointed out, I made a mistake last time, so I corrected it now. I hope it's correct now. So this document would be written as this bag. One instance of Tom, one instance of hit, one of this, two of balls, one of that, and one of and one of kicked. This is the bag representation where bag is made up of words. Okay. Suppose you were to make this as a bag of letters, then you would say things like C appears 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you'll say T, 5. Okay. And similarly, you'll say A, 1, 2, 3, 4. A would be 4. So that'll be a different bag representation. Notice that if I give you two bags, I can always compute the similarity because I can compute the intersection of the bags, which is the minimum number of the same thing that are present in either of the bags. So if I have one bag with 10 mangoes, another with 4 mangoes, then the intersection is 4 mangoes in terms of mangoes. Okay? And it has 3 bananas and 7 bananas, the intersection is 3 bananas in terms of intersection. So you could also do that in terms of these words. And you can do it in terms of letters. You can also do it in terms of sentences. Apart from sentences, by the way, you can also do it in terms of, instead of one word, you can do it in terms of what are called shingles. Again, you know, just think of this. The best metaphor I can do in terms of what you might get out of this course is if you had no work to do when you were in high school, you could have paid money to, you know, one of these organizations, like I think Johns Hopkins has a computer science exposure course, okay? And you'll go stay somewhere, pay a bunch of money, and in 3 weeks get some very high-level idea of what various areas are. And then, you know, you might find that some of them are interesting, or you might find that I wasted $3,000, okay? The only difference is it's like this that course, except you are not wasting $3,000. You wasted whatever money you were wasting, you know, in writing, you know, paying your tuition. The rest, so this has no marginal cost for you. Hopefully you learn a bunch of things and some of which might be useful. So by the way, shingles are, you could say K shingles, you know, a word is a one shingle. Okay, you know why they call shingles? On the roofs, you know, if you have roofs, then they have these shingles, and they actually kind of, one shingle is on top of another shingle, and they basically kind of, you know, overlap, okay? So a K shingle, so if you're looking for a 3 shingles, then Tom hit this would be the first shingle. Then hit this ball would be the second shingle. This ball and would be the third shingle, and so on. So now I can think of this as a bag of shingles. And bag of sentences is bag of shingles of arbitrary length, basically. Okay. So the question that the previous question was asking is, if I'm trying to compute the similarity between this and this, should I be doing it in terms of bag of words, or bag of letters, or bag of shingles? Where shingles can be of arbitrary size. So do people have any feeling, any intuition on this? So if you split these into letters, especially in, you know, languages like English, all documents are made up of exactly 26 letters. Right? All documents are made up of exactly 26 letters. And so it's likely that you would wind up saying many documents are similar to many documents. Okay? Which means if I give you a query, you will say everything is sort of relevant. And so you will return everything. Which means you will have a, of course, if you return everything, you'll also return a few things which are actually important. Okay? So you'll have very high recall, but very low precision if you do letters alone. Okay? If, on the other hand, you do shingles, then it's unlikely that, so for example, if I had Tom hit this, that ball and kicked as one document, and the other document says Tom hit that ball and kicked. So the only thing missing was this. you would suddenly wind up seeing that multiple shingles are different now. And so you would think that even though these two are really, you would say are very similar documents, you will say they're not similar. Your program won't say they're similar. So what that means is when it returns something, it's going to be quite similar, but most of the time it won't return enough things. So shingles will have high precision, low recall. And the words is sort of in between. They have little more precision than letters, little less precision than shingles, and better recall than the shingles, lower recall than the letters. Some of you actually wrote this. If you did, you know, you are understanding something. That's a useful thing. But if you get, by the way, actually just reading, I know that you, if you go to the blog, you can read other people's answers and repeat them. That's fine. Because in trying to read them, you're learning something. Okay, when I used to have, when I was in grade school, I used to have this teacher who would say review questions. And so we would feel as if we are ahead of the game because they're telling us exactly what to study. And I learned a little later that essentially he's making us study this way. He's giving us like 1,000 questions. And we think as if we are, you know, cheating the system by just reading these 1,000 questions. Except if you actually read these 1,000 questions and the answers, that's better than just going to a movie before the exam. Okay? So I am completely aware of the fact that the first people who wind up writing on the blog are the ones who probably are confident of their answers, and the other people who come to write their answers get to read the other people's answers. That's fine. That's completely fine. Again, you know, I'm not judging you exactly to give a, you know, grade just on this. The hope is you'll learn based on the discussions there. Okay. We should make this 4 hours. Okay. Okay. Wow. This one is kind of interesting. Actually, there was, you know, so this is set of magic words that people stick on their, you know, metallic doors. Clearly, it was not in this building. You know, we used to be in the Goldwater Center, right out there somewhere, right out there, okay, which is, you know, which used to be nicely in the main campus, so you would not have to run around all over the classes. But now we are here. You have a lot more restaurants than classes here, but that's okay. So in the, you know, we used to have metallic doors, and this guy used to have, like, you know, this magnetic words, and people will reorganize the words to spell interesting, you know, messages, and then go off. And the question I was asking you to think of is, obviously everybody writes a different message because English is order sensitive. So if you say Tom hit dog, that's different from dog hit Tom, even though the words are the same. By the way, you guys know other some of you probably hopefully know more than one language, and there are languages where order doesn't matter, okay, because the word ending tells you who hit whom or who bit whom, okay? In English, it's the word order that tells you who is actually doing the deed to who, okay? So in English, if these great messages are being written and you converted these messages into bags of words, then you found their similarity, what would they look like? They're similar. They will all be exactly identical because the number of words, there were 7 the words, and then there are 2 apple words, there are 3 banana words, and 4 some other words, and everybody using all the words. And so all of them essentially, even though English-wise, meaning-wise, their sentences are completely different, their passages are completely different, bag of similarity-wise, they're all identical. And the reason I want you to think about this is it sort of makes you realize how silly bag based similarity measures are. And yet, all search engines use this pretty much as default. That's what they do. Okay? So, all they can tell you is in the universe of documents, which are the documents that may be more similar in terms of bag of word similarities. But if the universe of documents were made from the same exact bag of words, then you are in bad shape, because all of them would be identically similar to your query. Okay. The last one, which actually we can then go back and look at the continuation of what we were discussing. So the last one basically was asking, if I increase, so if I take a file and just concatenate to itself to make it double its original size, would you first of all like to say that the similarity between your query and the file has increased, or would you not want to say it? So here's my question. Suppose you have a query for your search engine. There is a particular file, okay, which I would say upfront you would agree it is sort of 0.5 similar, 50% similar to your query. Now I say, I'll just take that file, make 8 copies of it, and just concatenate to itself. Would you then say it's 8 times 50% similar? Or would you say it's just as similar as before, no more, no less? What would you say? What would you like to say? I mean, just forget about search engines. What would you think if I just, you know, if you have a textbook, and you know, you're looking for which is the right textbook for this class, and you know, you pick the textbook and you found that's about 90% reasonable for this class. Now I just basically take 8 copies of that textbook and make it into a really thick, big book. Now would that be any more relevant to you than the other one? No. Right? So one issue that you should be careful about in defining any similarity metric is that it is not sensitive to the size of the file. You can't just return answers because those are bigger files than somebody else. Okay? So it should really depend only on the distribution of words in the document, not how big the file is. Not how big the document is. Okay? And the interesting thing is actually some metrics are not normalized, in which case they wind up saying it's more similar if you just double it. And you want to make sure that the metrics are normalized so that they're never sensitive to the size. Okay? In the context of, of the two we checked, one is the bag similarity metric, which takes the intersection divided by the union. Okay? The other is, if I'm talking about D1 and D2, okay, where D2 is D1 plus D1, okay, the intersection would be of the size of D1, right, and the union would be of the size of D1 plus D1, bag union, because one of them has more words. Okay, so bag similarity metric is actually sensitive to the size.
Does it have Google words?
It's not, thankfully. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
The search engine optimization, whatever. Like, don't they tell you they want more of the same words?
Yes, it is more of the same words at the expense of somebody else. If you just get more of all words the same, then it's not going to be better. So, for example, suppose you are looking for Rao, okay, which I hope you are looking for once in a while, and then there is one file which has 80% of the words in that file are Rao. Another file which has 20% of the words in that file are Rao. Then clearly 80% one is more relevant to you than 20% one. If, on the other hand, I have one file where I have 20% of the words are Rao, and another file which is double the size, which means it still has 20% of the words which are Rav, they're both equally relevant. Do you understand what I'm saying? So what search engine optimization tells you is put the words that people are looking for in higher frequency compared to the rest of the words. That's all. Okay? Just doubling the size of the file doesn't matter, because that means it's as relevant as before. Okay? And this is why when we did the vector metric, which I sort of tried to sneak it in at the end of the class, so now I have maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes to repeat it, so the idea is, instead of thinking of bags as bags, you can think of bags as vectors. Okay, first of all, just for sanity check, how many of you have heard of vectors before? Okay, a lot of you. A vector essentially is just a coordinate, a point in an n-dimensional space. Okay, you normally know two-dimensional space, your paper. A vector is like 2, 3 is a vector. That means you find the point 2, 3 in the graph paper and connect it from the origin to that. That is a vector. Okay. Now, of course, a bag is basically going to have, let's say if it's a bag of fruits, then each fruit corresponds to a different dimension of the space. I know that we can't think of more than three dimensions, but there are obviously many more than three fruits in the world, thankfully, right? So you might have, let's say there are about 1,000 varieties of fruits total, okay, then you are talking about a 1,000-dimensional space. And every fruit bag would be a vector in this 1,000-dimensional space. Okay, a bag which only has mangoes and nothing else corresponds to just the mango axis. It's a vector lying on the mango axis. Just as a coordinate which says 1, 0 means y-axis is 0, x-axis is 1, it just leaves. It lives on the x-axis. Right? Okay, so pure fruits correspond to individual axes. Mixed fruit baskets correspond to arbitrary vectors in this fruit space. Okay, now if I have two vectors like that, one way, if you think of them as vectors, then one way you can talk about whether or not they're close is in terms of the angle between those two vectors. In terms of the angle between those two vectors. If the angle is zero, that means they're basically the same vector. If the angle is high, then they are very different vectors. Okay? In particular, it turns out that if you don't have any negative fruits, okay, then all your fruit baskets will be in the first quadrant of your fruit space, if you understand what I just said. Okay, if, for example, I only have two fruits and I can only have positive and zero fruits, then all my fruit baskets will be in the first quadrant. Okay, which means what is the maximum angle any two fruit baskets can have? 90 degrees. Although normally you can have 360 degrees also, I mean not 270 degrees also. Since all of them are positive, then there's only going to be 90 degrees. So I want, if the maximum angle is there, then I want to say they are least similar. And the lowest angle is there, I want to say they are most similar. And if you remember the trigonometric functions, if you do cosine of theta, cosine of the angle, cosine of 0 is 1, cosine of 90 is 0. So it does it basically works out for us. Okay, then what's more, it turns out that there's a very cheap way, there's a very simple way of computing the cosine of angle between two vectors. Okay, which is, you take the two vectors, compute what's called the dot product. By the way, this you may or may not have heard, but when you take linear algebra class, you will hear about it again. So when you take some of the math classes, they are connected to, for example, things like Google. In fact, linear algebra is highly connected to search engines. You know, this is vectors, and then we will next time talk about page rank ideas, which correspond to eigenvectors over matrices. That's again a linear algebra. That's like the culmination of the normal linear algebra course you take. At the end of the course, you will learn how to compute eigenvectors. And page rank is an eigenvector of some matrix. That's what it is. And unfortunately, no mathematics teachers tell you this because they think Google is here today, gone tomorrow. You know, eigenvectors are forever. So you should learn eigenvectors just for the beauty of them, not because they're connected to Google. Okay? Although, for computer science people, if you tell them it's connected to Google, you probably will wake up and take some notes. Okay? So you heard it here at least. If I have these two vectors, so this is a 2 and 5 vector, this is a 5 and 1 vector. A dot product is multiply the same things and add them. So this is 2 times 5 plus 5 times 1. That's the dot product of these two vectors. Okay? And I do that divided by the size of a vector, you know, just from your, you know, Pythagoras theorem. The size of this vector can be easily computed because this is the hypotenuse of this right angle. So you just take the square root of square of 2 plus square of 5. That's the size of this vector, and similarly the square root of 5 square plus 1 square is the size of this vector. So if I take the dot product divided by size of vector 1 times size of vector 2, that will exactly give me the value of cosine theta. Okay, so we went from an intuitive idea that angle tells you something about similarity to an automatic way of computing the cosine of that angle. And it directly because, you know, linear algebra tells you that cosine theta of two vectors is basically from the dot product by the sizes. Okay, and the fact that you are dividing it by the sizes is essentially what makes this metric insensitive to doubling the size of a bag. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because if, in fact, this vector suddenly becomes twice as big, has the angle changed? No. That's why you use this. Okay? I have two more minutes, and I want you to think about, actually, I won't come to this, but, let me just show you this, because somebody actually asked this. Somebody said this either in the blog or in the last class, which is sometimes when you write a sentence, a word to Google, okay, suppose you are searching for me again and you are looking for Kambham Party, and it turns out Kambham Party spelling is this, but I don't expect you to know it. So you more likely than not have misspelled my name, okay? And then since I'm important enough, Google will tell you, are you looking for Kambham Party, right? Even if you're not important, it will tell you, okay? Why does it say that? It's a question of how does it automatically figure out what did you have in mind. It turns out this is bag similarity. One way you can do this is just using bag similarity matrix, okay? And the idea of shingles. And I'll just give you this and you get to go home today and think about it. Instead of, so this is a string called Kambham Party, okay? You can talk about shingles of this string. Shingles in terms of characters rather than words. And if you think of shingles in terms of characters, they're called grams. Okay, that's just a technical term. So if I look for 3 grams, then I say beginning KA is 1 3-gram. KAM, AMB, MBH, BHA, HAM, blah, blah, blah. So instead of this string, I think of this string as this bag. Okay? And then you type this. And I can think of that as this bag. Now notice that even though this and this are not the same English-wise because they're different strings, they're similar enough because really the only things that are present here but not present here are these, the ones in red. You see what I'm saying? Okay, so all that happens when you type something that's kind of close but not exactly related to anything in the dictionary, so Google or any search engine is sort of quickly computing. The interesting part is the quickly part, okay? But you should know how to even do it, right? And what it's doing is it's computing the similarity between the word you typed and every word in its dictionary. And if when the word you typed is already present, it would just go with it. If it's not present in its dictionary, then it will tell you, here are the close matches. Did you mean this other word? The same idea of looking for similarity between documents you can use for spelling correction. Okay, we'll stop here.